exist out there.
I lay that mirror down on the table between you and I. I can eventually get you to admit that the way the signal reflects from my face into the mirror into your eye, and the way the signal reflects from your face into the mirror into my eye, will obey reciprocity. I think I can eventually get you to admit
it's the first surface mirror, yes.
What happens if I make it a second surface mirror? However the signal goes from my face to your eye and your face to my eye, even with a second surface mirror, you're telling me that the reciprocity of that simple bathroom mirror with a second surface on it, you're telling me that that mirror sitting on the table is going to violate reciprocity. Is that your point, Eric?
Yes, actually, depending upon, you know, some other variables like the thickness of the glass, the material of glass made up of atoms, whether or not the glass is consistent throughout. Maybe it's slightly thicker on one side than the other. Yeah, okay, in terms of the effect of it magnifying on one, I'm thinking out loud now, the effect of it magnifying one side is going to be consistent either way you look at it, but when you think about polarizing filters, unless the waves are polarized exactly the way that the filter allows it to pass through, it passes through, but it works in both directions now, doesn't it?
By what you said earlier, you're implying that the bathroom mirror, if it was a first surface mirror, no problem. Because if it's a second surface mirror, there's a problem. Let's go back to the first surface mirror. I've got the first surface mirror sitting on the table reflecting a signal from my face to the mirror to your eye, from your face to the mirror to my eye. I think I've got reciprocity with a first surface mirror. Now I take a nice, clear, flat piece of glass and lay it on top of that first surface mirror.
All right, you're justifying clear, flat, you know, you've now guaranteed no variable.
Okay, so if the piece of glass I lay on top, that forces it to be now a second surface mirror, if it's flat, no problem. Now I'm going to allow you to take that piece of glass, I'm going to allow you to make it into a wedge shape, I'm going to allow you to put bumps and grinds into it, I'm going to allow you to make any kind of changes you want to that piece of glass that I lay on top of the first surface mirror. Are you telling me that now that will obey, that will violate reciprocity? The way the signal reflects from my laser pointer in my hand into the mirror combination into your eye, and then you've got a laser pointer in the exact same manner reflecting back to me, that those two reflections are not going to be the same. If I'm careful enough to make the alignment of the two laser pointers identical, it's going to obey, it's going to violate reciprocity.
You just switched on my argument.
Okay, so with my...
Right, let me give you, okay, because I was going to give you a polarization example where if I happen to be a light source that's reflecting off your face on one side, it's polarized a certain way, and I create a disturbance that only allows a certain polarization to pass, and the light source on the other side is different, it's not going to pass, so... You know, if you use two laser pointers, guaranteed exactly the same phase, then, you know, that trick isn't going to work.
I'm going to give you this one, Eric. There are crystal-like materials that that violate the daylight out of reciprocity. There are crystal-like materials that do that. That is known to be a chiral material, among other ways. So if I carefully choose the chiral materials, I can get failure of reciprocity. Mother Nature out in free air, in the radio waves that you and I transmit that reflect off the World Trade Center, I don't think it does that. I think 99% of all the paths you and I use in radio are going to obey reciprocity. That's an opinion, and I think you're telling me that 50% of them are going to fail reciprocity. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Yeah, what I'm saying is that there are certain lengths where that when you look at a high frequency signal, when you look at the phase of arrival from two different sources, two different timings, because one path is longer than another, and depending upon the reflecting material, especially as you get up into the higher frequencies, they don't behave exactly the same when they hit at a particular angle, let's say. I don't know how I can give you a real world example that explains what I'm trying to say.
Crazy.
You know, we've experienced it in dealing with when we made the transition to digital, because we're talking about symbol time that are, you know, 8 nanoseconds wide, and that little thing affected. It just would seem to make sense that using some of those examples, that when you're dealing with reflections off the building, you try measuring them, which is ridiculous, but you know, you need some form of standard in terms of what you're using to make the measurements with, and that in itself becomes difficult. Let me drop it.
If I now look at the inter-symbol distortion from a digital television signal that's transmitted from point A to point B, and multipath exists, and that inter-symbol distortion makes life difficult. If I transmit from point A to point B, and I get these various time delays of the multipath, and then I transmit from point B back to point A, are you telling me the inter-symbol distortion will change in magnitude because I've used the exact same antennas, but in one case I transmit and receive, in the other case I receive and transmit, the exact same antennas and the exact same path are going to have a different amount of inter-symbol?
Actually, you'll get the same amount, but the position of it will reverse. That's where the 50-50 comes in. In one direction, it will be the one data will be reading, and in the other direction, the data will be lagging. I don't have a good explanation for that.
I think you and I are getting down to the essence of whether or not there is a problem here, and whether or not it is real physics, misinterpretation of physics, misinterpretation of psychology. And I don't think we've settled this issue, Eric. I think you and I right now have sort of agreed to disagree. I have a little more faith in reciprocity than you do. You've seen examples of it where it is violated. And in the case of a dichroic crystal, I'm going to give you that. But Mother Nature has very few dichroic crystals out there in free space, is my belief. The ionosphere happens to be one of them. But we're going to...
Wait, dichroic is a very good band pass. Okay.
Okay, let me call it anisotropic chiral-like materials. Will you accept that as a exotic material that can...
Yes.
Okay, so now we've got a definition of the kinds of material that can create non-reciprocity. But that kind of material, I think there's very little of that in free space. Or if propagation paths, Eric, go ahead.
Anything short of the ionosphere yet. But there's just something about man-made structures that it still stands out to me. I mean, we've been pretty good at manufacturing jets that don't reflect radio signals, you know?
If I'm doing a stealth aircraft manufacturer and I'm trying to make something for bistatic radar performance, I'm trying to build this aircraft to be very stealthy in a bistatic manner. In other words, I'm transmitting from point A to the aircraft, listening at the echo at point B. And if I use my materials and my shaping of the aircraft, I do everything just right, and I make the aircraft very stealthy for the bistatic A to B path, I think I've got an equal amount of bistatic stealthiness when I go from B to A. You agree or disagree, Eric?
I'm not sure, because now we're talking about a disc pointing at an antenna, at a moving target, rather. And how do you go the reverse direction?
Okay, they've got a very specific antenna range out there to make these kind of measurements out in California. So I've got the sample aircraft stationary on a structure that in itself is not reflective. And I'm now measuring the bistatic radar cross-section of that aircraft. And I transmit from point A to the aircraft, and I receive at point B. And then I reverse the process. I transmit at point B, or into the aircraft, and I receive at point A. I'm now measuring the bistatic radar cross-section of that aircraft, and I'm testing the reciprocity of that phenomenon. Am I going to see a reciprocity violation in that steady state aircraft on that RCS antenna range? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Okay, I may be misunderstanding you a little bit, because if I shoot a signal at the aircraft that's stationary on a mount that doesn't reflect anything, well, the way the stealthy kind of thing works is it doesn't absorb the energy, it just doesn't send it back the same direction. Is that correct?
There's three different methods to make an aircraft stealthy. Maybe there's four. But what you described is one of the methods. Yes, I can scatter the energy in some other direction. I can be absorbing the energy from certain directions or towards certain directions. So absorption, scattering, and there are other techniques. So if I'm using all of these techniques that are passive, I'm only using passive techniques, and I'm not using chiral materials, will the bistatic radar cross section of that aircraft violate reciprocity on the steady state antenna range? Over to you, Eric.
Well, assuming that, let's say, we have 100% absorption, anything that hits it gets absorbed and doesn't get reflected, why, if I transmit from the aircraft, the stealthy aircraft, why should I not see a reflection come back at me from the ground? Although my antenna would have to be not in the stealthy part of the aircraft, because it would get absorbed before the antenna swallowed.
We got to be a little careful of terms here. You and I can say, I've got a perfect shield. And a guy can make a measurement and find out, yeah, what you think is a perfect shield is creating 100 decibels of attenuation. No shield is perfect. No absorption is perfect. So I can absorb X percent of the signal that hits the aircraft at this frequency. I can never absorb 100%. There is nothing that goes to absolute zero in radar cross section if you've got a sensitive enough system.
And then you have reciprocity.
And if your system is properly calibrated, I have differentiated by a number of techniques the difference between ground reflection and the aircraft reflection. I really know what the aircraft is reflecting. So now, if I use real passive materials that are non-chiral, will bistatic radar cross-section of that aircraft violate reciprocity? I think you're starting to say it won't violate reciprocity. Is that true, Eric?
All things being equal, yes.
Yes, it will or will not. Give me the full sentence. It will not violate reciprocity. Okay, if a stealthy aircraft does not violate reciprocity, and the building you're talking about is just something a little bit uglier than that aircraft, why will the building violate reciprocity?
Let's just imagine. It's one... I got a better example. This is going to work for you. I've got signals that have more than, say, 3 points on a thing. Let's say I have a fourth point. Right? And I add another path. I'm going to run into trouble with this, too, because then I'm going to go with... which signal is stronger, because maybe in one direction it's in phase and in the other direction it's out of phase, because one signal may be stronger coming from his antenna than from your antenna. I'm looking for a real world example here, and I'm having trouble, all right?
Dick? Yeah, I think you should have trouble, Eric, because if I do not move the transmitting antenna and do not move the receiving antenna, and my first experiment is to transmit from A and receive at B and then vice versa, and I can talk about the individual paths. Yes, there's multipath. There's five multipaths. And I add up path one, path two, path three, four, four, five. They all add up into a composite vector. But each individual path obeys reciprocity. Therefore, the compendium of all of those paths, I say, must obey reciprocity if I'm using purely passive materials and non-chiral materials. Each individual path obeys reciprocity, therefore the summation of those paths, If you believe in superposition at all, then that would have to be true. Over to you, Eric.
Alright. Well, interestingly, I just thought of this. Doing satellite work, when an airplane comes by, it can really create havoc because it's never in the same position. And the time of the reflection is constantly changing.
Yeah, we've held up people long enough on this one, Eric. For the time being, I think you and I have got some further research to do to convince each other of this phenomenon. But it's a good one. It's a good one to discuss because this one is highly misunderstood. And the history of this one, when I was working at the Great Peak Anechoic Chamber at Edwards Air Force Base, and where the chief engineer out there was absolutely positive that the echo we were getting off the foam on the floor from path A to path B, from point A to point B, and then point B to point A, he wanted to convince everyone that the foam would have a different amount of absorption depending on which way the signal was flowing. And he went down fighting on that one, ended up leaving that company, and there's a whole lot of story to that one. So reciprocity failure with simple passive materials, this is a tough one. People have argued about this one for years. You and I are going to discuss it some more. And maybe next week or the week after, we'll come back with...
You know, if I never had any experience with this, I probably would just be very passive about it.
Understand. You and I have each had experiences, and now we got to be careful how we interpret our experiences. An awful lot of your experiences were moving targets, an aircraft reflection, for instance. And now, point A to B and B to A, the aircraft is not in the same position on the second test, and therefore it's hard to judge. But in the case of an anechoic chamber where you've got everything locked down, and now you measure A to B and B to A on that locked down chamber, everything I've ever measured tells me reciprocity is not violated. We'll soon find out. John, I know we've kept you waiting enough a long time. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead.
W2EO, November 2.
Next.
KC2WGB. Dick, one question on that. If the aircraft was outdoor and it's mounted on that pylon or whatever, when you transmit from A to the aircraft, B receives. When you transmit from B, goes to the aircraft, A receives. But now, that's only good, reciprocity only applies if the reflection and absorption is the same at those angles. There could be a difference because of the shape of the plane. It's not linear.
Well, here we go.
You've got a good sounding theory, Eric. And I've watched people argue that one for a long time and eventually lose the argument. What you're using is good, common human sense. But Mother Nature doesn't give a damn about your and my common sense. You actually perform the experiment. You say, holy blank, how the hell did the two signals, A to B and B to A, end up identical? How the hell did Mother Nature do that? You'll eventually say those words and scratch your head. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
And 2 Echo Oscar.
I hate Mother Nature. By the way, Dick, I'm a little confused with this antenna that we started this speech about. Now, on the first page under the performance schedule, it claims close to 100% efficiency. So what was in the narrative is not what they're saying here. By the way, it takes 900% less of radial area. Okay. So there's something, and the dimensions, it's only 6 foot wide, 3 feet high. 6 foot is the widest point. So I think this antenna is worth giving it a shot and see what happens, because you concur with this thing could work, and that's what I want to know. So, all right, I think we may have beaten this to death, but I was wondering about that because I'm looking at the building, the question about the AB function is because looking at the building, with its irregular surfaces, if it's striking it differently, I thought you would have some results. But, okay, let me let it drop.
That reminds me of the guy that built the AM broadcast antenna on top of a small building.
There was a whole bunch of guys 10 or 15 years ago, Eric, making these so-called EH antennas, or they were were going to separately generate the E field, separately generate the H field, and they thought all kinds of magic was going to take place. And a few of those people were in the broadcast industry claiming they were going to go build this antenna. They were going to get more efficiency, smaller structure, cheaper antenna, faster, cheaper, better. And all of a sudden, we haven't heard from those people. KE2EJ, KE2RAW, and those are good broadcast people, Eric.
You wouldn't know, but they seem to have disappeared off the planet. There was a lot of hoopla in the days that that was being thought about. Nobody was really successful at it. What's his name? Bendo. He passed away recently. He was like, guys, try all you want. It ain't gonna happen. And it was funny the way he used to say it.
You're back to your very low audio, Eric. You got to remember to put that mic in the same place. I think it was a group of guys in Holland who are going to go build that antenna and connect it to their broadcast station, and all of a sudden they turned very quiet. Great sounding theory on paper that if I separately generate the E field and the H field, I'm going to somehow get some kind of magic and let Mother Nature recombine them out into space. And it doesn't work that way. And these separate reflections at crazy angles off your reflecting object, John, no matter how you do it, when you actually perform the experiment, you'll almost always find reciprocity is not violated, even though the diagrams you draw on the paper and the thinking of your brain and the way you mentally picture this whole scenario, you say it can't possibly do that, but it does. Because if you take it apart one pass at a time, each individual path obeys reciprocity, and what Mother Nature does is she adds up all of those voltages of all those individual paths, comes up with a composite vector, and whether you do it from A to B or B to A, all those individual components each obey reciprocity, therefore the whole multipath has to obey reciprocity if you're not using exotic chiral materials. KC2WGB, K2RW, that's what I've discovered up till now, John.
John, Dick,
KC2WGB. Very, very good, Dick. I'll take your word for it. It's just amazing how some of this stuff goes. All right. I have a question here from a young man who's heard of an antenna. He'd like you to describe it if you've heard of it. And what I think this is a vertical waveguide, but I'm not sure. It's called a wedge tail antenna. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't. That's a new word to me, John. So try to describe it if you've got a picture.
Well, I don't know where it's used, but its image to me looks like a something that's about 6 foot long, 4 foot high, and about 8 inches thick. And it's called a wedge-tailed antenna. I believe it's used on aircraft. That's why I thought you'd be familiar with it or may have heard about it. But this is a new one on me. Although, to me, it looks like it's an assemblage of some kind of waveguide.
Okay. What frequency range? You told us 6 feet wide, 4 feet high, a few inches thick. Is that mounted against the vertical stabilizer of the aircraft? What frequency range? And in what direction do you believe it radiates, John? Go ahead.
Dick, I don't have a clue. It looks like it mounts on the very top of the fuselage, back at the tail section. That's the way it's designed. That's the way it looks. But I have no frequency range or any other information, just the name, wedge tail antenna. Okay.
I got a picture of it, Dick, and it's kind of like an A-Lance antenna, except it's not... round.
Did you say AWACS antenna?
The Airborne Warning and Control System is a whole military program of about 20 years ago called AWACS. Westinghouse, among other people, were involved in it. And is this a conformal antenna, Eric, in the picture you're seeing? Is it conforming to the fuselage of the aircraft? Possibly it's a patch antenna, a conformal patch, KE2EJ, KE2RAW.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I had a phone call. It looks like an AWACS antenna. Actually, it is the, the Australians use that particular version. So, in essence, you may think it looks like a feature waveguide, but what it is a radar.
Okay, the AWACS antenna was really this pancake shaped structure mounted on the top of the aircraft, which rotated. Is that what this thing looks like to you, Eric?
Yeah, it looks exactly like that, except it's not round. It's, it looks like a rather large, radar antenna with a radome on it. Not a round radome, you know, just covers the antenna. Actually, here it says the RAFF Wedgetail Aerial Refueling. The radar antenna array also doubled as an instrument array with a maximum range of blah, blah, blah. So it's, they call it a NEPA radar antenna. That's whatever that means.
No way you could rotate, Dick.
So the picture you're seeing, John, leads you to believe that it doesn't rotate. And go ahead with any further description you've got, John.
It doesn't rotate.
Yeah, that's what I thought, because it looks like a sandwich, white bread sandwich, standing on the edge. If that thing rotated, the plane would stop.
So if it's standing on edge, does that mean this thing looks like another vertical stabilizer, John?
Yeah, Eric may have a better picture, because mine is sort of mixed sketchy. That's the best description that I could get out of the drawing. But it sounds like Eric's found exactly what it is.
Thing is, I've got a close-up picture of it. It looks like it's on an elevator, that it can actually raise the height of it on the top of the fuselage. It's towards the back. It's not that close to the tail, but I'm sure aerodynamically they had to deal with it, because it looks like it has a little bit of an edge on it.
You used the word NISA or something like that earlier, Eric. Spell that word. You said that it has some of the property.
M is a Mary, E is an Edward, S is in Sierra, A is an Alpha. Built by Northrop Grumman. Let me open this up and see if they actually spell out what the acronym means. It's been covered in Avionics Magazine, a whole bunch of things here. So, I don't know. Looks like it's been around since 2010 or 2002. It's called a multi-role electronically scanned array.
Okay, because it's electronically scanned, it does suggest that within that radome, there are multiple elements, and you're able to change the amplitude and or phase angle of the signal to those elements, and those elements then construct some kind of a beam out in space, and you can steer that beam. That's what that all suggests, Eric. So inside that radome, there may be a whole bunch of individual dipoles with individual transmission lines going to a what's called a beam-forming network, which adjusts the amplitude and phase of the signals going to those elements. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, here's their explanation. The MESA antenna is an innovative aperture that provides a 360-degree azimuth scan with no mechanical rotation. Attached to the top aft section is a fuselage. It consists of advanced composite structure that supports side-emanating electronic manifold arrays and a top hat and fire array. The ultralight foam composite sandwich construction, yeah, John, enables state-of-the-art performance at a fraction of the current system weight, thereby allowing additional time on station for the aircraft.
Yeah, electronically steerable antennas are becoming more and more popular. In the past, they were very expensive to make that beam-forming network, but with modern-day microwave integrated circuits, that's becoming easier. That's what I think we're discovering here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
very good, Dick. Yeah, there's not too many events where you hear about a new antenna or something you haven't heard of, for sure. But this one threw me for a loop. I couldn't help it. It does look like a sandwich. But very good. I think it's time to go over to Paul and see what's happening with NASA. So, everybody enjoy the night. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
And to extend whenever you have a time.
Yeah, let's go over to Paul first. Paul, what is NASA doing these days? WS2N, K2LIW.
This is WS2N. Hi, Dick. Hi to everybody on the net. And, yeah, there's always something going on. And, for instance, SpaceX has got a lot of flights coming up this year. And the problem they're having now is getting flights off the ground. I think last year they only got 3 flights off the ground, and they've got like 50 flights on their manifest. So I'll be talking about SpaceX quite a bit, but I think they got 3 flights left this year to the space station, plus a whole bunch of other commercial flights going. Now they have a pad at 39A that they just took over for 20 years. That's the pad that they use for the Apollo program. They use that for the space shuttle, first space shuttle, even the last space shuttle. Although they have another pad, 39B, that was also being used for the shuttles. Now SpaceX has got control of that. They have another one, Launch Complex 40, also at the in Florida. And they've got another one in Vandenberg Air Force Base they've taken over. Another one they're building down in Texas. They've got all these flights planned and places to launch things from, but they're not manufacturing the Falcon 9 fast enough, so they're having a little problem meeting their responsibilities. I want to mention one of the experiments that just took place on the International Space Station a couple of days ago, and they call it the OPAL. It's one of these optical laser deals. It's actually called Optical Payload for Laser Communication Science, and mounted on the outside of the ISS. And as they were coming over near JPL, JPL sent a signal up, a laser signal up. It's this instrument, and then the instrument looks for that laser, and it adjusts, you know, azimuth and elevation motors to, you know, beam right back to the receiving scope at JPL. And what they did is sent a video message down. This video message would have taken normally 10 minutes to transmit RF. This 2.5 watt signal on that laser, it only took them 3 seconds. So the idea is to eventually use this on a regular basis. Of course, it's line of sight. They can't beam up to the teacher's satellite. But they're working on being able to send huge amounts of data back. This RF is just not fast enough. You might remember about a month or two ago, we talked about the LADEE program, that, you know, the rocket that went around the moon, launched by Orbital Science. And they had an experiment on board, and they did a similar type of thing. Transmitted actually to the White Sands, Mexico area, and I was successful also with a laser. So, naturally, I try to follow those stories. You know, it's just a form of communication. It's not RF, but way up there in frequency. So, interesting developments. They're going to run more tests with this thing as well. I know, Dick, you're interested in the frequencies you know, the laser, so I did read that. It was 1,550 nanometer, so a billionth of a meter, you know, for the laser. And they ran the test for a couple of minutes, a little over 2 minutes, and they actually sent a video called Hello World. Look that up on the internet, put it in Hello World, and, you know, it's a short video that was transmitted down from the space station. One other topic I wanted to cover, I talked about this last week, and it was supposed to fly the LDSD mission, the low-density supersonic decelerator test vehicle that NASA built. They're going to test it out in Hawaii. They've got this big balloon that they're going to float the space, well, if you want to call it a spacecraft, this test saucer-like dish up to 23 miles, and then they're going to drop it, and behind that it has a rocket. It looks like a big flying saucer with a rocket behind it, and it's going to ignite. And that's going to bring it up to Mach 4, up to 180,000 feet, where the air is very rarefied, similar to what you would find on Mars. And the whole idea is to test this inflatable system. You know, you take a heat shield and you can, like, double its size by inflating these huge bags that surround it. So, you know, you go from, like, you know, maybe 16 feet up to like 20 feet in diameter, and then they have another one that they're going to test next year that goes up to 26 feet in diameter. And the bigger it is, the slower it will go. And once they get it to slow it down for 1,000 miles per hour or so, be able to test their second part of the experiment, which is a little over 100 foot diameter parachute. And the biggest ones they've used so far are a little over 50 foot diameter ones. They used them on Curiosity, even way back in the Viking days when they put these two Viking spacecrafts on Mars back in the 70s. And that's usually about the biggest they can make it. But now they need 100 foot size parachutes. The only way they can do that is they don't have any air tunnels big enough. So I know I brought that up last week, but for anybody that wasn't listening, that's a repeat. But it didn't go. They had the weather is not cooperating in Hawaii, and they've had a couple of different dates that they've set. And now, actually, they have a date for tomorrow, but it's almost promising. It may be up to the 14th of this month. I'd like to see this thing take off. The animations I've seen look pretty good. This is WS2N. And that's pretty much it, Dick. I don't have that much. There are a lot of launches coming up this year. I think NASA has 10 or 12 launches that they haven't launched yet that we'll be looking forward to. We'll talk about on the net. Next one would be this month, actually, the 16th of June. Orbital Science has a launch from Wallops Island down in Virginia, a couple hundred miles from here, and it'll be sending cargo up to the space station. So the middle of this month. And that's pretty good. If you go out, even in the daytime, you can see the rocket engines from the, sort of star going up to, maybe 5-10 degrees above the horizon. And in July, they're going to launch another one from Vandenberg Air Force Base using a Delta II rocket. And that's going to be called the Orbiting Carbon Observatory. This OCD, Orbiting Carbon Observatory, idea is to really test the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere. Now, if you've been watching Cosmos, Actually, tonight is the last in the series for Cosmos. They're up to 13. But if you saw number 12, they talk a lot about carbon dioxide. Neil deGrasse Tyson really made a good case showing that global warming is a real thing. All kinds of good evidence that he had. And how just a couple of percent higher carbon dioxide in the atmosphere could really screw us up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Spacecraft is going to help look into that CO2 problem. Drop it. So it should be a pretty good year. We got another progress mission going up after that. An automated transit vehicle built by the European Space Agency. It's the last one that they're going to be sending up. They sent one over, up about every 8 to 9 months so far. And I think this is the fifth one, so this thing sends up about 3 times the amount of weight that a Progress craft could send up. It attaches to the Zvezda Russian module, and after unloading it and everything, it'll stay attached for 6 months. It'll load it up with garbage, and it will burn up over the Pacific Ocean. But it's so large, it's got so much fuel, that they'll be able to give that space station an extra before they deorbit the ATV, automatic transit vehicle number 5. And with that, you've got at least 3 SpaceX cargo missions to go up to the space station. And by the end of the year, one we'll probably talk about, motorcycle anyway, is the launch of the Orion spacecraft. It'll be launched from Florida on a Delta 4 configuration, Delta 4 Heavy. So it's the equivalent of taking 3 Delta 4s, bolting them together, putting an Orion spacecraft on top with a service module. Service module's big. In fact, it's being built by the same company that's building, that builds these ATVs, these automatic transit vehicles that I was talking about. And one of the reasons they're not going to make any more ATVs is this company is not going to use this frame, this whole very similar setup to what they use for the ATV. They'll be making the service modules for the Orion, part of the Space Launch System. It'll be launching that thing in December for its first test. Orion will go up to almost 4,000 miles and 2 orbits around the Earth, and they'll bring it back to the Pacific Ocean. They're going to see how that does. That will get a lot of news attention. I know you're going to see that on news, hit out on the radio back, in December when that comes up. So that's pretty much it. You got the European Space Agency with Rosetta coming up, following that comet around. It's going to have a land that it lands on that a couple of months from now, and we'll follow the MAVEN mission. And that mission will go into orbit around Mars in September, and I think 1 day earlier than India. India has one going to Mars. Or MOM, but that's going to go into orbit as well. So there's a lot of missions to follow. They're trying to just concentrate on the NASA ones, but European Space Agency, Russia, Japan, now India, and even China, a lot to keep track of here, Dick. Back to you, Dick. Any questions, you can reach me on SpaceNet Report. Report at gmail.com. To that website, LimeMarkNet, LimeMarkTechNet.com. There's a space section there you can click on as well. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2L. We'll be standing by for questions.
Let it full reset, Dick.
Dick, how about picking me up when Paul is done? N2EO said that.
I'm letting the machine drop. John, I think you've been monitoring the Echo Link, and I wonder if anyone has been trying to get through. I guess when I can turn it back to you, you can tell us of that. Telling you guys that we now, John monitors the Echo Link, so if someone is having trouble getting through because we don't let an edge in word-wise, we don't wait long enough, at least now you stand a chance of finding out you're trying to get through to say something. Also, there's ways that you can send John messages during the net itself, I guess by chat room or other techniques. When it comes to higher frequencies of communication, the Voyager spacecraft, on its approximately 8-foot diameter dish, it transmits its signal from 8 billion miles out all the way back to Goldstone by way of 8.5 gigahertz. If the technology would have allowed it in those days, if they had used twice the frequency instead of 8.5, if they used 17 gigahertz, the exact same dish would give you 6 decibels more gain. You get 6 decibels more gain every time you double frequency for the same size dish. That would be a much more narrow beamwidth, much more directed, stronger signal to the Earth, based on the assumption you can aim it accurately. So if you take that to the ridiculous extreme, let me drop. The same size antenna, higher and higher frequency, gives you more and more gain, more and more signal strength, as long as you can aim it directly, aim it accurately. So therefore, you go all the way up to light. It doesn't surprise me at all that we're starting to do more and more experiments with high data transmission by way of optical techniques, and that the 1550 nanometers that you talked about, John, here we go, Paul, that communication just took place. The optical region that your eye operates is roughly 400 to 700 nanometers. That's the wavelength that your eye operates at. Takes it 700 nanometers and a little bit more than double it in wavelength, half the frequency, and you got the 1550, which is near infrared. So the near-infrared is a real nice frequency for transmitting data. I'll bet you quite a few of the fiber optics cables, and there's zillions of them being installed these days. New York City, you talk to K2PPN, and he's installing more and more cables every single day in New York City, all kinds of hours of day and night and weekends and whatever. They just can't get enough cables below the streets and inside the buildings in New York City, and they're operating on essentially infrared frequencies, and you get ridiculously high data rates. 10 gigabits, 40 gigabits per second is relatively easy for these days, if you know what I mean. So optical is the way to go, as long as you can aim it, and as long as you don't have to transmit through a cloud. So that makes an awful lot of sense, and I see a lot of a future for that one. One of the questions I've got for you, Paul, and that is, I know that the pin feather alignment technique of Kepler was about to start taking place. I wonder what's the progress of that. And I believe the European Space Agency is also launching a Kepler-like spacecraft, which I believe is going to monitor even a larger number of stars simultaneously, looking for exoplanets.
Repeater, time out.
Give us a few words on that, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, right. Well, Gaia is up there. That was launched I think the beginning of this year, or maybe the end of last year. And that was by the European Space Agency, launched out of French Guiana, South America. And that's operating. They do have another one planned, but that's probably maybe 6-7 years down the road by European Space Agency. They just planned another one. I don't know what the name is now, but it'll change by the time they take off. The Kepler is now operating. I just read that about 2-3 days ago. So it came online. They're not going to be staring at one point in space. They're going to follow the ecliptic around. So as we orbit, it will orbit around the sun, and a little different type of science, but it'll still be looking for exoplanets. We're doing other work as well. So that'll be good. We have another one that will be launched after the test. That will be launched 2 years from now. And that's going to go into a P2 orbit lunar cycle type of thing. Every time the moon goes around, it's going to be going around twice or something way out there. Almost to the orbit of the moon, dropping. But that'll be a planet hunting type of thing. Right now they're up to, I think they said almost 1,000 confirmed planets. So, there you go, Dick. They've got these ground-based telescopes down in Chile. Another one just saw first light about last week, I think. And that's going to block out the light from the stars. And it's going to look actually planets, and it'll hook up spectroscopes to it that we'll be able to tell what the atmosphere is like. I forgot which one that is. Just came online. Actually, there's two of them now. One's hooked up to the Gemini, and then the new one. And they showed the first picture that they pointed to some star, and you could see already they have. See the vapor gas accretion disk around one of the stars, and that's just the first picture. When they get it really going, they think they'll be able to actually see planets. It's very hard to do. It's not like Kepler. Kepler blocks out the light, and they say, okay, it happens every 70 days or 5 days. And, they know there's a planet going by. But this is different. These things will actually be able to look at the planets. Eventually, James Webb Space Telescope will be able to do the same thing. Back to you, Dave.
Letting it slowly drop. Doesn't look like it wants to. Or wants to drop. The Kepler, if I remember correctly, Paul, Kepler had a very elaborate mask with a zillion little bitty pinholes in it, so that when Kepler was properly aimed, very specific stars were being studied. The light of very specific stars was coming through that mask, and therefore any minor modulation of the light of that star represented a planet in orbit around that star, going in front of the star, and therefore changing the amount of illumination you get. That was my remembrance of the way Kepler worked, this very elaborate mask. So if Kepler is coming back online and is going to look into any other direction in the universe, then that mask is no longer properly tuned to that direction. So I'm a little curious about that. Maybe this is a different kind of operation of Kepler. I'm curious as to why we're not going back to the same direction of orientation. When it comes to the European Southern Observatory, ESO, a beautiful optical astronomy setup in the mountains of La Salina, Chile. Let me drop. They have arguably one of the world's best optical astronomy installations, very similar to Mauna Kea and Mauna Kea, I think it's pronounced, in Hawaii. And there's also a real good setup in, I think it's the Canary Islands. But I think you said they're going to block out the star light and look at the planets and the other material circulating the star. When you block out star light, in the past, one of the ways of doing that is something called a coronagraph. It's a very specific optical setup where you put a small blockage in the optical path, if you do it real carefully, which blocks out the star without blocking out the things that are around the star. So I wonder if this new telescope that just came online in Chile is called a coronagraph, Paul. Tell me about Kepler. Why is it looking in some other direction? Is it changing the method of operation? And was that a coronagraph? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, they call it a coronagraph, but it doesn't look like the ones I've seen, you know, like you see the picture from SOHO, that's the one that's a million miles out, following the Earth around the Sun. You know, you always see this black disc, looks like light coming out from behind it. You can see the corona mass ejections coming off our own Sun. But this, it is a coronagraph, they call it that, but you see no light from the star. It looks like a blue background, light blue background. And then, what they showed was this disk of material going around the Sun, around the star. And that was pretty bright. So that's what I saw so far. They released, I guess, that one picture. And as far as Kepler, yeah, that's the K2. Well, the momentum wheels, they've all failed. That had four on board. One failed. The other one was backup in E3. Well, the other one failed. And that was the end of that last year. So now they're using the solar panels as wings. Light hits the solar panels. They're able to keep it steady, but only in one orientation. It's going to look at the ecliptic as it goes around. Well, no longer able to turn, drop it. I never hear four tones. I hear three all the time. I can never pick out four. And I'm good at CW. I don't know where that fourth one is. Since they can't spin up the momentum wheels, make it move one way and then slow it down, back it off to go the other way. As it goes around the Sun, they can't they can't keep this thing pointing at that one location that they were for about 3 or 4 years. So that's why the mission has changed. And as far as the mask, I thought that was just on the Gaia project that European Space Agency launched. That was them. I don't remember Kepler having the mask. In fact, you just have to look it up.
Yeah, I'm going to check on that one also, Paul. So we got some nice spacecraft going up, and it does look like the search for exoplanets, which used to be considered a crazy project. I mean, any kind of a steady search for extraterrestrial intelligence in the past, I can't think of his name right now. The guy who wrote the original equation, telling you how often you're going to find something.
Frank Drake.
The guy, Frank Drake. He got a lot of flack at first when a lot of disparaging remarks were being talked about him as doing such a mystic project, doing such a crazy thing that's going to have no chance of success. And we've come full circle on that. SETI searches and exoplanet searches and whatever, we're suddenly admitting. We're being humbled again to believe that we're not the center of this universe. Can you imagine, Paul, that in the beginning, everybody on planet Earth, per se, believed that the Earth was the center of the universe and the whole universe of planets and stars and whatever all revolved around us? We were given this very prime position in the universe, and we've been humbled about five times in a row. Our planet is not the center. Our sun is not the center. Our sun is not the center of the galaxy. Our galaxy is not the center of the universe. It's only one of the members of the local galactic group. Five times in a row, we've been humbled, and I think we're about to be humbled a sixth time, because I see it as more.